can't just keep spending more than you're taking in and say life is going to be peachy. That's head in the sand thinking.
Governor Parnell outlines his priorities for the rest of the session. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage voters shake things up on the Assembly and School Board.
We'll see how it all pans out, but I think they're mad as heck and they're not going to take it anymore.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The most recent version of the oil tax overhaul has a new price tag, almost $5 billion over the next 6 years. Mike Pawlowski with the Department of Revenue explains.
If the bill passed and nothing changed from the way the department currently forecasts the next 5 years, this would be the fiscal impact that we would see.
Oil prices could end up being different from the state forecast, and that analysis doesn't take into account any changes to oil production, whether they are good or bad. The version of the bill offered by the House Resources Committee has a lot of moving parts, and a couple of them have indeterminate impacts on the state treasury. The way this version works is that it would set a 35% ceiling on what oil companies could be charged. When dealing with new oil, the state would let a fifth of the new oil go tax-free and then give a $5 per barrel credit for the rest. With old oil, it would offer per barrel credit based on a sliding scale. At high prices, companies wouldn't get the credit at all, with the idea being that the state should benefit from the rise in profits. But at prices as low as $80, the state would give companies an $8 credit. The argument for including that provision is to spur oil companies to invest in the state. But that policy has Representative Paul Seaton, a Homer Republican, worried about what happens to the state treasury if the price of oil crashes. He thinks it might not leave the state with enough protection at the low end.
I'm concerned that $8 isn't just at $80 a barrel, it's everything below $80 a barrel, so that it becomes a much higher and higher proportion of the profitable income that's going to be excluded if we reach a time where we have low oil prices.
The House Resources Committee has spent this afternoon reviewing changes to the bill. More than 24 amendments have been offered. With less than 2 weeks left to the regular session, legislators are focusing their attention on the budget and with getting to a vote on major bills like oil tax reform. Governor Sean Parnell sat down with APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez to talk about what he would like to see in these final days. He says he's not concerned that oil companies have testified the latest tax reform bill doesn't go far enough.
I'm not in this for the oil companies, I'm in this for Alaskans, and our independent experts tell us that this bill now moves the needle on production, increases investment opportunities for companies, and in doing so creates more job opportunities and more revenue for Alaskans.
And I've heard from sources that you have a scenario showing the consequences of not changing the oil tax structure and that it paints a pretty grim picture for the state treasury. What does that look like, and why aren't you using that to make your case to the legislature for SB 21?
Part of the reason is because anything beyond 5 years gets more and more speculative because we don't know what the price of oil is going to be. But I don't have, you know, a plan in the back room or something that shows the state crashing. But we know from looking at the 10-year fiscal plan that we submit every year to the legislature that we begin draining reserves, and we've begun draining reserves this year. So you can't just keep spending more than you're taking in and say life is going to be peachy. That's head in the sand thinking, and that's We're taking the totally different approach, which is here's the five-year fiscal plan. Here's what we can do together to create opportunity for Alaskans.
On the subject of that five-year fiscal plan, I spoke with your budget director, Karen Rayfield, last week. The idea basically is to keep the budget at $6.8 billion for the next 5 years. Is that still what you all are considering?
It's actually to ratchet it back a little bit from $6.8 billion a year by about $25 million increments. And I don't have that in front of me here, but effectively it would keep it between in that $6.7 to $6.8 billion range. The other key component, though, is to limit draws on reserves on our savings accounts to $700 million or less per year. So, you know, those are key elements of maintaining fiscal restraint and managing our way to new production.
This week, a bill advancing an in-state gas line project passed the House. Between that, the Fairbanks gas trucking plan, the Susitna Dam project, and the obligation to AGEA, we have a number of energy projects that have us on the hook for over $1 billion. Given the proposed spending cap we're talking about, how do you keep on advancing those projects? I mean, these are expensive projects, and we also have a large operating budget and capital projects that are important to legislators.
So the five-year fiscal plan that I put forward had a caveat to it, and the caveat was that we can exceed the spending limit for a statewide legacy project, one that benefits all of Alaska. A gas line certainly fits into that. The key is that we not fritter away the state's savings on little spending projects around the state year after year and keep increasing that. The key is that we manage our way through the 5 years coming forward and then have some left over that we can make big investments with. Additionally, when you speak to, for instance, the cost of some of these projects, if you look at the Fairbanks Interior LNG project, the trucking project, we're talking $50 million of general fund spending. The vast hundreds of millions of dollars are in the form of loans that would be paid back by the users of that gas. So it's, you know, we're not just talking about straight cash for every project. We're working to think through these and make a smart project, you know, for all Alaskans.
Governor Sean Parnell speaking with APRN's Juneau reporter Alexandra Gutierrez. Senator Mark Begich says everyone will need to feel the pinch of sequester, so he's decided to return a portion of his salary to the Treasury this year. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
It's not uncommon for federal officials to donate some money to the general coffer. President Barack Obama just announced he's returning 5% of his $400,000 annual pay. Staffers at the Office of the Secretary of the Senate say the gesture happens every year. Senator Begich's office is not saying precisely how much it will return just yet. The senator is forcing more than half his staff to take furloughs. His spokesperson says the amount Senator Begich returns will be calculated from the money saved from those furloughs. If one employee loses 5 days, Senator Begich will return 5 days of his salary. Begich's congressional office was allotted more than $3 million last fiscal year, with most going to salary. The second biggest line item was travel expenses. Official travel is covered. Senate financial disclosure forms show that Senator Begich could be worth as much as $3 million. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating local foods in Sitka.
Pickled gumboots, pickled fish, smoked fish, dried fish, herring eggs.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Register now for the 2013 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, May 2nd and 3rd at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. This fifth annual conference offers participants an unmatched opportunity to network with national industry experts, learn the latest on policies, programs, and projects in the clean energy industry. Online registration ends on April 26th. More information at www.bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP, your voice for renewable energy.
Four Anchorage area men have been arrested in connection with the sexual assault of a 17-year-old homeless girl. Anchorage police say the four men, aged 19 to 21, are alleged to have detained, abused, and sexually assaulted the girl in a home in suburban Eagle River. APD spokeswoman Danny Myron.
All three of those suspects gave her drugs and alcohol, threatened her, physically abused her, and repeatedly sexually assaulted her. At one point the following day, the three perpetrators were joined by another man named Joseph Sanford, and the alleged abuse of the young female continued. The sexual assaults reportedly took place over a two-day period.
Myron says the girl is now safe with her family. The four men are Alex Metzger, age 19, Ryan Poole, age 21, Jesse Contreras, age 19, and Joseph Sanford, age 20. They are being held on a total of 33 charges. It was hit and miss for Assembly candidates backed by conservative Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan in Tuesday's municipal election, and the makeup of the Anchorage Assembly looks like it will be shifting. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has this report.
That's supporters cheering as the votes rolled in for West Anchorage write-in Assembly candidate Nick Moe.
It's amazing the amount that this campaign was able to accomplish in 2 weeks. And regardless of the outcome, you know, I am so pleased. I think we sent the message that the public process should be followed, that, you know, we should have leaders that listen to us, not shut us out of testimony and the public process. And so regardless of the outcome, I'm very happy. It's very encouraging to be ahead at this late in the game. But, you know, we still have a long way to go both tonight, and we'll see what happens, this next week or so.
Moe and Assembly Chair Ernie Hall were neck and neck, trading places for the lead all night long. At the end of the night, Hall led Moe by just 93 votes. Hall received 3,628 votes, that's 50.65%, while write-in Moe had 3,535 votes, or 49.35%. 26-year-old Moe, who works for the Alaska Center for the Environment, launched a write-in campaign late in the game. He said he jumped into the race with only 2 weeks to go in response to Hall's handling of AO37, a controversial ordinance that stripped municipal workers' unions of power. Hall oversaw a vote of the Assembly which ended a public hearing before everyone had a chance to testify. Hall said Moe's success was due to support of unions, especially those representing firefighters.
People are going to jump on a bandwagon. In this case, it was the Firemen's Association that decided that they wanted to get behind Nick Moe and help him get elected, and they spent a lot of money and put a lot of man hours into it.
Six of the 11 Assembly seats were on the ballot. Chugiak Eagle River candidate Amy Demboski, who was endorsed by Mayor Dan Sullivan, won her race. The paralegal, who also sits on the mayor's City Budget Advisory Commission, beat out two other candidates to replace outgoing Chugiak Eagle River Assembly member Debbie Osiander. Demboski said she ran in support of the mayor's controversial ordinance, but she's ready to work on a reconfigured assembly.
I live in facts and data, and that's the type of decisions that I'll make. So regardless of what the other side's saying or what my side's saying, if you will, I will always be fair and I will always do my homework. And the facts and the data will say what they will, and our community will speak. And whatever my community says that they want, that's the direction we'll go in.
Cheryl Frasca, the mayor's former budget director, who was appointed to fill the West Anchorage seat left vacant by Harriet Drummond after she was elected to the State House, lost her race to Tim Steele. Steele, a former school board member, said voters sent the Assembly and mayor a clear message.
Well, I think it's a message from the voters that they're not real happy. It seems to be a change election, and so we'll see how it all pans out, but I think they're mad as heck, and they're not going to take it anymore.
Midtown Assemblymember Dick Traney beat out conservative challenger Andy Clary, whose politics align closely with Mayor Sullivan's. Traney says he's looking forward to change on the Assembly.
There's going to be a major shift in this Assembly. I think Nick's going to win it. So we'll see what happens. I know Steele's going to win it for sure. I think the public is speaking. We're going to listen to them. If there's a big change, to reorganize the assembly and put it back where it needs to be. Everybody that comes down to testify gets to be heard. And we'll go from there.
Assemblymember Paul Honeman, who ran unopposed in East Anchorage, agreed with Traney.
I think their message is loud and clear. They want to respect the public process. They want their local elected officials to listen to them.
Mayor Sullivan blamed special interests for shifting the terrain of the election. He said they were responsible for giving Hall an unexpected run for his seat.
Here you've got, again, special interests pouring a ton of money and a ton of ground support into a write-in campaign against a candidate that, quite frankly, didn't really intend on raising money. So I think it kind of put Ernie at a disadvantage, if you will. But Ernie Hall is a great guy, a great gentleman, a great leader. He always tries to find consensus, and I think he's going to prevail in this race ultimately.
It won't be known for a week or so whether it's Hall or Moe who will prevail. Officials with the municipal clerk's office say there are more than 2,200 early ballots yet to be counted, and an unknown number of absentee and question ballots. The write-ins don't get counted by name unless Moe gets more votes than Hall. The election is set to be certified on April 16th. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
In other Anchorage election news, two former Democratic state legislators, Eric Croft and Betty Davis, were elected to the school board. The State House Finance Committee has given the okay to a bill, HB 23, that would create a fund to pay for the proposed Kinnick Arm Bridge construction if tolls during the first decade of the bridge's life don't cover costs. Yesterday, the Senate Finance Committee took up its companion bill, SB 13. If SB 13 gets out of committee, it heads to the Senate floor for a vote. Matt Nuscavalli lawmakers are sponsoring both bills. Kubota spokeswoman Shannon McCarthy says the fund is a project reserve, which allows Kubota to pay for the project once it is built and open to the public.
It's really to create that assurance in the marketplace so that a private sector consortium can come and build the bridge.
She says at first there will be shortfall in tolls, but after about 9 years, the tolls will exceed the payments that Kubota will make to bridge construction partners. However, opponents of the bill say they are being heard without the benefit of a required legislative budget and audit review. The LBA audit is expected to be released by the end of this week, according to Bob French, an Anchorage resident opposed to the bridge.
Seems to me a little bit premature to be discussing this in the finance committee before you have the results of a financial audit done by the LBNA.
Wasilla Representative Mark Newman, who sponsored HB 23, has introduced a committee substitute for the bill during the House finance debate, which would limit state liability for toll shortfalls to $1.14 billion. But French says the HB 23 change only allows the state to write a check for $1.14 billion.
They don't know how big of a contract that Kubota will be signing. Nobody knows how big that contract is going to be. So the ultimate liability to the state is to make what they're calling availability payments. And Kubota estimates that those availability payments in their last finance plan was $2.3 billion over a 35-year life of the contract. The state will be signing blank checks before they know how much those checks are going to be for.
Bridge opponents estimate the costs of the bridge to be more than $2.6 billion. French says if Kubota fails to get a low-interest federal loan to build the bridge, the cost of construction will go up, and the state's payment will rise accordingly. Kubota spokeswoman McCarthy says the bridge will cost about $1 billion. The state has put $10 million in this year's capital budget for Kubota, followed by $35 million a year for the next 4 years that would set aside a total of $150 million for Kubota to fill the reserve fund if it is created.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
Senator Lisa Murkowski hosted a Senate hearing on subsistence in Bethel yesterday afternoon. More than 25 people spoke, and many more submitted written testimony. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes reports.
Welcome home.
That's the sound of relief. After 2.5 hours of intense testimony, people finally stood and stretched. Moments earlier, the sentiment was different.
I get emotional when I think of what happened this summer.
Sarah Jasper of Bethel recounted the subsistence fishing closures last summer on the Kuskokwim River when her son's salmon net was seized by law enforcement. He was fishing during an unprecedented 12-day subsistence closure for king salmon.
When we fish and put away for winter, we only take what we need. Please have a heart and let us ease off the land what we were raised with.
A handful of people spoke in Yupik, but many bilingual speakers used English to get their points across. And many spoke about their trepidation going into this fishing season after last year's disaster. Jackson Williams from Akiak told Murkowski that his tribe abided by the state's 7-day closure, but when they extended it 5 more days, the elders told the village to go fish.
They were craving to eat that food. All of us, I think, that were born in the Kuskokwim River, when they first come up, we pray for them to eat, because, you know, that's our number one food.
People said they didn't want to take the blame for the decline in the king salmon runs on the Kuskokwim and Yukon rivers and shouldn't be the ones carrying the burden of conservation. Several people voiced their concern with king salmon bycatch. Angie Whitman of Bethel got emotional when she spoke about it.
There is an incredible lack of justice with one group legally allowed to waste salmon. Given the term bycatch and other group dealing with severe restrictions, being issued citations made to appear in court, and paid fines.
People also testified about their frustration with state management. Again, Jackson Williams of Akiak.
We've been trying to get help from wherever, Department of Fish and Game, fish commissioners on the state side, you know, but nobody is listening to us. Nobody.
Several people spoke about the need for tribal co-management and greater tribal involvement. Stephen Maxey of Nebuskiak suggested leaving the state out altogether.
We need to work government to government so we can co-manage it. Leave state alone. State can work under us.
Even some Bristol Bay residents flew to Bethel for the hearing, including Dennis Andrews Sr., who implored Murkowski to take everyone's testimony seriously.
It's our dinner table. Even the water's our dinner table. And on the land, it's still our dinner table. Berries, game, moose, you name it. Birds that come in and nesting. It's our dinner table for thousands of years back up to today.
Murkowski made no promises and reiterated the reason for the hearing was to form record for the Senate. She said she clearly got the picture that everyone there was dissatisfied with the way things are. She said the hearing will help her explain what's going on to her colleagues in D.C.
It's difficult for me to convey so many of your thoughts. So the fact that you have shared them on the record here today is extraordinarily important.
Another similar subsistence hearing is tentatively scheduled for May in the Otna region. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Rob Kanine is a chef from Anchorage and the founder of Fresh 49, an organization that raises awareness in Alaska about the benefits of using local foods. As part of his tour through Southeast earlier this spring, Kanine stopped in at Sitka's Mount Edgecombe High School and taught a cooking class. Although Kanine is a Tlingit with roots in Petersburg, Sitka, and Metlakatla, he is a ready hand with delicacies from other regions, including muktuk sushi. Mount Edgecombe Junior Chanel Afghan is involved with the Fish to Schools program. She attended Kanine's class and sent this audio postcard.
So I've got some cooked rockfish because I knew that I didn't have a place to bake this. And I broke it up into smaller pieces. I've got the rice that's already cooked. So we've got a hot pan, got these vegetables cooking.
My name is Rob Kanine. I'm an Alaskan chef, and I'm currently living in Anchorage, but I was born in Southeast Alaska.
Just crack an egg or two, actually maybe three.
So tonight we came in and to homeroom here at Mount Edgecombe High School, and we made some fresh rolls. And what I like to do is take something like a fresh roll that's pretty common and then integrate sort of traditional foods into that. So kind of a contemporary recipe with traditional foods. So we had the rice paper, the spring roll wraps, and vermicelli noodles and carrots and celery. But then we accented it with smoked salmon and sea asparagus and goose tongue and black seaweed. And then we had seal oil as well. So that's nothing that you would ever get at a restaurant or anything. But at the same time, it's something that kind of takes those traditional foods and gives them kind of a new light to look at as far as what you can do with them.
Who are you and where are you from?
Pilani Myers, and I'm from Angoon.
So have you ever eaten the spring rolls before?
I've had Thai spring rolls, but not this. It's really good, only because I put the ingredients in there.
What's your favorite traditional food?
Pickled gumboots, pickled fish, smoked fish, dried fish, herring egg salad. Yep. Okay, cool.
My name is Kara Ingram, and I'm from Dillingham.
Okay, Kara, what's your favorite food from home?
Probably salmon berry agouda.
How's that made?
First, like, you pick the berries, and then you add sugar and Crisco, yeah. And you mix that all together, and then you eat it.
Omega-3 fatty acids or vitamin D are pretty much, vitamin D is found pretty much by sun. So in your environment where there's no sun, these, you know, like whale, seal, salmon, all have rich omega-3 fatty acids, which really help.
My name is Tracy Ganyu, and I am the community sustainability organizer for the Sitka Conservation Society, and I coordinate the Fish to Schools program.
What did you hope for students to take away from the cooking class today?
I hope that they had a sense of connection to home and that they're excited about trying different foods and getting creative in the kitchen and just having an opportunity to actually cook and be hands-on, because I know that's something you guys don't get very much of.
My name is Trevor Wiseman, and I'm from Chifornik.
What's your favorite traditional food from home?
Big bird with honey on it.
Why is that your favorite food?
Because my mom makes it, like, so tasty.
Student reporter Chanel Afkan is a junior at Mount Edgecombe High School. She's from Nunum Iqua on the mouth of the Yukon River. Kaneen's visit to Mount Edgecombe was co-sponsored by the Sitka Conservation Society and Search Health Promotions. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Angela Denning-Barnes in Bethel, and student reporter Chanel Afkan in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Do you own a business or manage employees? Do you reassure employees with children that you're committed to supporting them? Well, research shows that employees who feel supported at work when handling their parenting challenges are more loyal and more productive. When you let employees know they can attend a parent-teacher conference, stay at home with a sick child, or adjust their schedule to secure quality childcare, you contribute to stronger families. This message sponsored by Best Beginnings, Alaska's Children's Trust, and Strengthening Families Alaska.
The University of Alaska Anchorage, where a freshman computer science course sparked a six-figure career in digital game design. The University of Alaska Anchorage, amazing stories being written every day. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.